So we can begin this afternoon session just with some reflections on Dhamma and this morning I mentioned the theme of training or sikha as a distinguishing characteristic of the approach of the Buddhas, and a discourse of the Buddhas comes to mind that kind of exemplifies that. And the Buddha gives the image of a goldsmith in smelting gold and making it suitable for making jewelry pure enough, malleable enough, that a goldsmith would put the gold in its crucible and have the fire on, and from time to time would periodically sprinkle water on it just to cool it down. It's getting a bit too hot. From time to time would periodically blow on it with the bellows, increase the air, increase the heat, and periodically would just watch it closely, would examine it. And of course the Buddha then compares this to practice and to training, and saying that one would from time to time would periodically attend to the theme of one's theme of concentration. One would periodically attend to uplifted energy, and one would also periodically attend to equanimity and observation, so that these are different aspects that one has to bring to the practice at different times. There are times when one has to bring up energy because there's energy is flagging, or the mind is not very bright, or there's a particular need, other times there needs to be a relaxing, a settling, a cooling down of all of the processes, at other times we just have to learn to be very patient and observant. And there isn't a formula in terms of a fixed method of when each one is applied. And one has to, they're applied according to the results of the practice. As if one, in the same way that if a goldsmith just kept pumping the bellows and just overheated the whole process, then that would ruin that refining of gold. If there was all it did was cool it down, sprinkle water on them, it just would, nothing would happen. So that similarly in practice, we have to be able to be attentive to what are we experiencing, what's the state of mind, what's the quality of mind that we're bringing to this present moment, and how do we work with it. And of course that is the training, so that learning how to bring this quality of training into the meditation, into the not just the meditation, into our daily life. But in particular, right now we've got the opportunity to have some time for meditation, so to be directing attention for its benefit. Now, as we take a meditation object, and I'll tend to refer to mindfulness of breathing as the meditation object, but that's my own preference, and I tend to use that as I use it myself, and I tend to that's where most of my experience is. But it's applicable to whatever meditation object one is familiar and comfortable with. But as one's taking taking the breath as the object, then one has to be willing to keep returning attention back to the breath, not in a an overbearing way, not in a tight and controlling way, but you can't let the mind just wander and flit around. That mind that wanders, is restless, flits around, is not useful. It's not an ideal tool, so that we can, in attending to the breath or attending to the meditation object, when the mind wanders, it's just patiently bringing the mind back to that object again, and that is the byword is that patience, in the sense of being willing to be patient and persistent. If the mind wanders once, you bring it back once. If it wanders 10 times, you bring it back 10 times. If it wanders 100 times, you bring it back 100 times. If it wanders 1,000 times, you bring it back 1,000 times. It doesn't really matter. The result is much more in the attitude with which we are willing to direct our attention, bring that quality of patience and persistence to our efforts in meditation. That's what will bear fruit. So that too, that sense of being willing to recognize when the mind has wandered, and then to be willing to reestablish our attention. There's a tendency to assume that the mind has, I mean, and has gone somewhere, in the sense of when my mind wandered here and there, and thoughts were ranging over this and that, and the reality is the mind didn't go anywhere. It's just attention has not been directed, it's not been focused. As soon as you reestablish awareness and attention, there, the mind is right there. And it didn't actually go anywhere. All you were doing, you weren't paying attention to it. So that the being willing to recognize the nature of the mind, and to abide, learning how to abide in its ability to attend, to be aware. Of course, there are inevitable obstacles, hindrances, that the that come up, and to be able to become skilled in dealing with them. The word that the Buddha uses for hindrances is nivarana, which is it's literally a hindrance, an obstruction, that which clouds over the mind's natural clarity. So to be able to become attentive to these different hindrances, in the sense of being able to recognize, well, that is a hindrance, and I need to do something about it. The Buddha gives an image of a mountain stream, when a stream comes down the mountain, and the stream is starting to come down the mountain, and then that channel that it's running down, if there's kind of little side channels going off in different directions, then the strength of that current is diminished and decreased, doesn't have much strength or power. Whereas if the if this mountain stream coming down is whatever side channels there are, if they're blocked off and they're held in a single channel, then that current will have tremendous power and strength. And you can attest to that at our monastery, which has a lot of slopes. We're on mountains, on a mountain, very steep, and that's how we heat our cabins in the winter time, is using the water, channeling it, and putting it through a turbine, creating electricity, and heating our cabins with that. So that if you can direct that water in a contained and undissipated way, it has a lot of benefit. So the same with our mind. And these various side channels and distractions that come up are what the Buddha called hindrances. Sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, / worry, and skeptical doubt. So these are natural tendencies within the mind. Even though they may be natural, that still doesn't mean they're not a hindrance. So we need to learn how to be able to close those channels off and give ourselves the opportunity to experience what it's like to have the mind that is not entangling itself in what is obstructive. Another image that the Buddha gives is of gold, or of the goldsmith, and saying that there's these five impurities of gold: tin, silver, copper, lead, something else. My mind is not very clear right now. Iron. And the Buddha is saying that as long as any of those impurities are in the gold, say tin, lead, iron, silver, copper, as long as any of those are in the gold, then that gold is not going to be lustrous. It's not going to be malleable. It's not going to be luminous and bright. Similarly, when that gold is purified, is made pure by removing those impurities, then the nature of that gold will be malleable. It will be lustrous. It will be of great value, and be able to be molded into beautiful objects. And then the Buddha goes on to say that this is similar to the mind, in that there are these five hindrances: sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, worry, and skeptical doubt. So that we give ourselves the opportunity to learn how to diminish and weaken the strength of those hindrances. Now, usually when we think of these hindrances, for those who are familiar with teachings and have done retreats before, it's usually taught in the way of these are hindrances to meditation and concentration. But it's actually a much broader sense in the sense that it's not just sort of freeing the hindrances so that you can experience more peaceful states of meditation, but it's really learning how to work with the nature of the mind itself, in that the Buddha uses the structure of dependent origination to talk about the coming into being of desire, attachment, becoming, and then all of the attendant experiences of suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, all of the whole catastrophe. And the first link of dependent origination, or the seeming origin, is pointed to as ignorance, avijja, lack of true knowledge. And with, say, avijja as cause and condition, there's the arising of sankhara, the conditioned phenomena of mind, and then leading on from that. But there's discourses where the Buddha then draws one back to, because it's easy to think, well, there's this primal ignorance, sense of the origin of all difficulty, but the Buddha points to the fact that even ignorance, avijja, is a conditioned phenomenon. And of course, that's what the Buddha pointed to, everything as being a conditioned phenomenon. So why would ignorance not be a conditioned phenomenon? And then the Buddha, when the Buddha asks the rhetorical question of, and what is the, what is the cause and condition for avijja, or of ignorance? And the Buddha answers by saying, there's five hindrances. So that these five hindrances, besides the direct benefit that one gains in terms of overcoming hindrances and through the overcoming of those five hindrances, besides just the settling of the mind, the clarity of mind that arises, one is also directly undermining those fundamental lack of true knowledge of the way things are. Of the nature of things around us, so that it's also a causal condition for the arising of discernment and wisdom. So working with these hindrances, being able to investigate and to look clearly, what as I'm sitting in meditation, paying attention, in breath, out breath, long in breath, short in breath, long out breath, short out breath, really attending to the those sensations, trying to focus attention, settle the mind, what are the patterns that are coming up in the mind? What's sort of coming up and being an obstacle, and how to deal with that? Sense desire arises, and you know, how do we deal with it? Fantasies come up in the mind, just looking at something other. Give me something other than the breath. Give me a break. Let me have my fantasy. And wait a minute. That in itself, even if it's not some gross sensual desire, it's just the mind looking to something else, some gratification somehow, somewhere. America has a great phenomenon sometimes with bumper stickers. I told you one this morning. There's another great bumper sticker in the Bay Area. It's me, sometime, somewhere else, happy. exactly what goes on in my mind all the time. This is I will be, if only I were somewhere else, with somebody else, someplace else, then I'd be happy. There can be really good logic for that sometimes. But the reality is it's generated through that fantasy of gratification elsewhere, somewhere else, in the external senses, the sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, somewhere else, and just the buying into that is enough to cloud the mind. And to be able to recognize that that tendency, be able to see that clearly, to understand what that assumption, where it keeps leading us. When the Buddha. He gives the five hindrances, and there's also in talking about the settling of the mind, the stability of the mind, the first stage of real solid stability. The first jhana, and it's characterized by five different qualities, and they're often lined up in opposition to the hindrances, so that the qualities of the first. Of that initial stability of the mind are directed thought, evaluation, joy, happiness, unification of mind, and those are that's a way to direct attention when you're practicing, in terms of these are qualities to bring up and encourage in the mind. And They are qualities that go directly against these hindrances. The unification of mind is considered to be a direct antidote to the to sense desire, that quality. And it's interesting that probably in terms of unification of mind is the kind of the culmination and the balance of those faculties. And sense desire is always going to look for some object until the mind is kind of unified and settled and content within itself. So that it's not a matter of just wishful thinking that sense desire will go away, but it's realizing, well, that's really it's really persistent, it's really sticky, and one has to be willing to be persistent and attentive to not get hooked. The quality of ill will, you know, in working with ill will, it's the standard antidote is usually that is called for, usually recommended. Is loving kindness, and that's of course that's excellent, sublime antidote. But it's also, you know, when there's ill will around, negativity, aversion. Loving kindness is not the first thing that comes to mind usually. So that learning to pay attention, well, that's ill will, and saying, yeah, this is painful to be able to have to carry around ill will, aversion, negativity. So that I've always found has been much more helpful to. Really pay attention to the, what's it feel like to be harboring ill will and aversion, and also one of the things that I found was also to what's the particular view, opinion, or desire that is being thwarted. That is making me feel averse. So that being able to see the underlying root of that aversion. In that structure of lining up the hindrances and these five factors of the mind settling, what is usually pointed to is joy, in the sense of, you know, being able, some joy, something, some well-being, some joy, some quality of joyful quality, and to be able to look or respond to circumstances in a way that allows that quality of joy to arise, and that underlines the momentum or the inclination to ill will, aversion, quality of that's sloth and torpor, is overcome, and the antidote is the first quality of vitakka, directed thought. As soon as you're able to direct thought, directing attention, directing one's thoughts, there's not going to be any drowsiness, sleepiness. Sleepiness, drowsiness, dullness. It's able to get a purchase in the mind because one is not really something. It's not clear. One's letting the mind drift a bit, letting things be a bit vague and loose, and it becomes a bit amorphous and nebulous. And then all of a sudden, your head's on the floor in front of you, or your neck is broken in meditation. It's sitting there, or swaying back and forth. And it's that simple act of lifting up the mind to an object. When Ajahn Chah used to speak of the meditation, in terms of these factors, he would use directed thought, vitakka, that's what you do. You lift the mind up to the object of the breath, and it's a constant and repetitive exercise. One lifts up attention to the breath. Then one sustains that thought, directs that thought in a sustained way. And one is, sometimes it's called sustained thought, sometimes it's called evaluation. The evaluation is probably a better word. So that direct, lifting up the thought, lifting up the attention to the object of attention, to the breath, and then sustaining, evaluating, looking at it from different angles. Inevitably, it's the nature of attention, it is impermanent, and it'll start to drift. As soon as it's recognizing it, it's starting to drift, you lift up the attention to the breath again. It's that vitakka vichara, vitakka vichara, vitakka vichara. As you develop that momentum, then the mind becomes more clear and bright. The quality of joy becomes a well-being. There's both a physical and a mental quality. But it begins with that willingness to keep returning to that lifting up attention to the object of meditation, directing attention to the breath, as we do that, it becomes more interesting. Sometimes it sounds mechanical, as if you could just pound your mind into submission, but it doesn't work that way. You have to take an interest, and taking an interest in, and that's with the breath. You're taking an interest in the sensation of the breath, in the experience of the breath, in the experience of the body as it's breathing, experience of the quality of mind as it's engaging with the breath, so that there's an interest and an attention that is being sustained. And anyway, that as we apply that vitakka, then that in itself is the antidote to, say, to sleepiness and drowsiness. And if sleepiness and drowsiness comes up, then it's like lifting up the attention again. If you just sink into the feeling of drowsiness and nebulousness, then the sleepiness takes over. And it's not as if it's unpleasant. There's a certain kind of relief to it. But it's not a fruitful quality within the mind to be cultivated. It's that the cultivation should be much more directed to that directing of attention, directing of thought. The quality of restlessness as a hindrance is overcome through sukha, or happiness. Sukha is both a mental experience, but it's all more of a physical experience. It's sort of pleasure in the body. One is feeling very relaxed, a softening of the body, and an expansion of the kind of perception of the mind. So this feeling of pleasure and happiness is a restlessness is overcome through that. Actually, the experience of happiness or sukha, especially as one's been cultivating these wholesome mental states and overcoming hindrances, the experience of happiness is very important. The Buddha actually, there's some discourses where he gives the causal links of development of the mind, and emphasizing this quality of sukha, of happiness, and actually very explicitly saying, the happy mind is easily concentrated, and the meditators, I mean, most of us have probably worked from an axiom of that when I get my meditation together, then I'll be happy. And it's actually the other way around. You get your happiness together, and you'll be constant. Your meditation will grow and develop. And concentration will settle. To attend to, well, what is it that is actually happiness in from the Buddha's perspective? His qualities of well-being and the wholesome brightness of mind, of heart. And the quality doubt, or skeptical doubt, being overcome by vichara, the evaluation, the kind of investigation, the sustained thought, when we're able to clearly evaluate and sustain attention. Well, then there's a clarity that arises. It isn't just an intellectual understanding. It's a dropping away of that tendency to wavering, to uncertainty, because there's that clarity is much more tangible, is much more convincing than all of our niggling proliferations. So that as we practice and cultivate this practice, then there's we've got some might sound all very complicated. You know, you've got the five hindrances, and you've got the five aspects of the settled mind, and there's this and there's that. But in reality, I mean, there is just the experience of this body, this mind, and the breath is one thing to be attentive to. It's one out of many things that one could be directing attention towards. And then it's really just being able to take an object of attention and to be able to sustain that, and then to start to be interested in what's happening. So what is it that is going to be fruitful for settling and clarifying and stilling of the mind, of the heart? What is it that's going to be helpful for relinquishing, letting go? Because the path that the Buddha has given us is really not one of attainment and achieving anything. It's really about relinquishing and letting go. Our freedom comes from that. The peace of the mind, in whether it's in meditation, in terms of meditative states of stillness, the more willing we are to relinquish and let go of those hindrances, the more peaceful the mind will become. Similarly, in terms of wisdom and discernment, it's about learning how to relinquish and let go of the habits that are associated with greed, hatred, delusion, and habits of that are bound up with desire and ignorance. So that these qualities of attachment and clinging that mind keeps deferring to, they can be relinquished, they can be let go, they can be seen through. And that's what our meditation is for. Really being able to see these tendencies, see these habits, recognize them for what they are, and to be able to relinquish, to let go. There's a phrase that the Buddha uses in a few occasions in the suttas, where he's explicitly giving a short summary of his whole teaching, and in the Pali it's sampedam manalam apinivesaya, and it can be easily or loosely translated as saying all things are not to be clung to or not to be adhered to. So that sense of non-clinging, non-attachment, letting go, all things. So that's, if we want a theme to keep referring to, that will take us from the beginning to the end of this path, is to be being attentive to okay, what can I relinquish? What can I let go? What can I not cling to and adhere to? And that will hold one in good stead. So I'll offer that for reflection this afternoon.
And my own Dhammakataya Sarvukaranvidhamasi.